This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. Carl, Angela Merkel has acknowledged Germany's unique history as one reason for her stance on refugees. However, it seems from your remarks that her position comes more from compassionate choice than from historical guilt. Would you agree?
I would agree, but I would add that it was also a decision in the national interest. No doubt, she being a daughter of a pastor grown out in a Christian household, feels very strongly about refugees. But I would also say she did the right thing in terms of being chancellor of a country, of the richest country in Europe, which has this past. Germany cannot escape its past. That if Germany hadn't done it, would have been severely criticized. Something had to be done at the moment. And would you have liked to see 100,000 people somewhere camping on the borders of Germany? That was totally unacceptable. And it was partially due also to the failure of the European Union to accept a redistribution of refugees, which didn't take place, so Germany had to act, and she did. In a way, she acted also in the interest of Europe.
Thank you. A first question. Another driver of migration seems to be excessive population growth. Would you please comment?
Population growth in some countries produces a great deal of poverty, that's true, and they look outside to find relief in other countries where there may be jobs. And of course, Europe being rich and wealthy and not as distant as the United States, which is after all protected by two oceans, a nice country in the north, and a country with which it cooperates in the south. The Europeans, where do they go? They go to the nearest place, which is wealthy. That happens to be Europe. And the countries that do suffer from population growth are usually the youngest country. As I said, 50% are under 30. And they are looking for employment. They don't find it at home, so they try to find it elsewhere and are even willing to risk their lives to get there.
Thank you. Many refugees are finding themselves in a cycle of poverty. Educated people forced to work minimum wage jobs. How can this be avoided? And I'll add, is Germany doing something specific toward this question?
This is the problem of all receiving countries and of refugees. Same happened here in this country and still happens here. People come with a degree of education which cannot be immediately put to purpose and used. Very often they go through a transitional stage of doing simple jobs. That has happened to American immigrants, and it is happening now to the immigrants in Europe. The biggest problem that the immigrants in Europe now have is the language problem, because they immigrate to a country where there is a difficult language and they don't speak it. And the center of the integration problem is language learning, which is taking place. The other problem was in the past that in practically all European states, the right to work was limited, if non-existent, for migrants until their status was recognized. That is now changing. And lots of low-level jobs, 100,000 I read, will now be created with a federal subsidy so that migrants can use them. Germany, for example, has 1 million vacant jobs. 1 million. It's a very prosperous economy, which is moving up in its value-added ladder, and it needs skilled people. They're not necessarily skilled. Some are. I mean, there are doctors, for example, or nurses who come, but most of them are not skilled. So it will take years. On the other hand, let's keep in mind that every European country is in demographic decline, some more than others. The German working population will sink from 45 million now to 35 in 2050. They all need immigration. Now, it takes time to integrate, as we know very well here. But that is a process that is underway. And the Europeans are trying to learn from the experiences of the past. Germany and Sweden, which are the two countries with the largest number of immigrants, have looked at what has happened in France and in Belgium, where the local terrorism grew in the ghettos and districts where they lived together. For example, now the asylum seekers are not allowed to move where they want. They are assigned places in order to avoid the creation of ghettos. And even as the housing program has started, it's a big housing program, it's quite a boom in Germany, they will be not done in such a way that they all live together. That is one of the consequences. And that also that the teaching is combined, the language teaching is combined with the teaching of the social and political customs of the place. So that, for example, people coming from traditional Muslim societies will have to accept that women enjoy the same right as men in our society, and that the order, the political order of the host country must be observed, as well as the penal code. So that is combined with the language training now.
Thank you. Please comment on Vladimir Putin's support of right-wing parties in European countries.
Well, Mr. Putin, not surprisingly, likes as companions parties which don't believe in democracy. So he has actually given loans to the Front National in Paris, and he receives right-wing leaders from Western Europe who sympathize with him. At the same time, it can be argued that Putin's refugee policy is hybrid warfare, because his intervention in Syria prolongs the drama and produces more refugees, and the refugees will want to go to Europe. At the same time, he lets thousands go the long way from the south to all the way up to the north to cross the border into Finland and into Norway. Of course, that isn't done without the approval of the authorities. So the Norwegians and the Finns now also have a refugee problem produced by Mr. Putin deliberately. So that will continue. The Putin policy is based on creating sympathy in the anti-immigration right. But hopefully it will remain a minority and not really affect policy. And the latest incidents in Germany, if I may add that, last week, they were really horrible. The reaction has been very calm of the public, despite the fact that, of course, the AfD party said this is a confirmation how wrong the policy is, and even the Bavarian prime minister, who is a Christian Democrat, but always different from the rest of the Christian democracy, attacked Chancellor Merkel on the policy. But the reaction was calm, and Mrs. Merkel interrupted her holiday to comment, and unlike some others, and we know them here, I don't want to mention names, she did not hype up the incident.
Thank you. How would the refugee crisis be affected by the end of the Schengen Agreement, if that were to occur?
I didn't mention, for reasons of time, the implications of the refugee crisis for the internal movement. The European Union, most of it, not all of it, all of the members have an additional agreement, which is called the Schengen Agreement, whereby all controls of the internal borders are removed and replaced by one common external border. Britain is not part of it. By the way, non-members like Switzerland and Norway have also joined the system. Now, that cannot be maintained under the circumstances with all those migrants moving around, so there has been a revival of control at the border. For example, in Ventimiglia, on the Italian-French border, you will find policemen. And when you take the train from Cologne to Paris and you arrive in Paris Nord, at the end of the station, there are people in dark uniforms that look at you and control if they think you're an immigrant. So the Schengen Agreement is at the moment basically suspended, although all members in the agreement would like it to come back, partially for economic reasons. Because at the moment, a truck can go through, say, from Sweden down to Italy without seeing a bureaucrat. That saves time and money. And if you restore the border, it costs money. And the distribution networks, which were European-wide for the various economic actors, wouldn't work anymore. So everybody's interested in restoring as much as possible the Schengen Agreement, but it's very difficult. One reason more to transform this into an orderly managed system. I wouldn't exclude that after a year or two, we would come back to that.
Thank you. Do you agree with Germany's policy towards Turkey and specifically Merkel's willingness to compromise with Erdogan regarding freedom of the press?
One has to keep in mind what is happening here. Turkey has been an applicant to the European Union for several decades now. Turkey is already a partial member of the European Union. There is a customs union between the European Union and Turkey. Goods flow freely between the two sides. There are lots of Turks working in the union, more than 3 million in Germany. The negotiations, however, got more and more bogged down as Turkey under Erdogan developed into an autocracy. And the criticism of making Turkey a full member has grown for years now. Angela Merkel herself, like her predecessor Helmut Kohl, said Turkey cannot become a member, but we will have a special relationship with Turkey because it cannot fulfill the conditions. And now, of course, it looks worse from that point of view. But given the influx of refugees, or most of them coming from Turkey, crossing the few miles to the Greek islands just in front of the coast, and then from there, then they're in the European Union, and then going north, made it necessary to get Turkish cooperation. The Turks can easily stop it. It's no problem at all. And they watched it before, and some people made a lot of money in the bureaucracy, but also this private sector that I mentioned. 40,000 people take part in this sector. There was, at that moment, a good case for making an agreement with the Turks and saying, all right, we will give you money to improve the fate of the refugees in the country, in the camps in particular. You will get visa-free access to the European Union, which the Turks don't have yet, and we will accelerate the discussion on the Turkish membership. At that time, of course, many people objected because of what was going on in Turkey, which has gone worse after the coup. The question now is, what do you do? Are you behaving like a realist and make a deal on the matter or not? Or use the fact that Turkey has now turned into a real autocracy to stop cooperating with Turkey? Turkey is also a NATO member. Turkey's contribution to fighting ISIS is indispensable. So you cannot cut the links if you are a realist. That's the world we are in. So I would say there's really no choice but to cooperate with Turkey. But what the question implies is that the European Union has accepted the treatment of journalists. That is not correct. It has been vividly criticized. The European Parliament has done so, the governments have done so, the press does so, the political parties do so. But what can they do? Erdogan is in charge, and he is the only available partner now. And of course, we will continue, the Europeans will continue, as will the Americans, will continue to criticize what goes on internally. But both the United States and the European countries have to cooperate with the government to deal with ISIS and to manage somehow the flow of refugees.
Thank you. You have spoken of increasing development aid to the countries that are the source of refugees. Two people have asked about the effect of corruption or dysfunctional governments in those countries and on the promise of economic progress in developing nations. How would you suggest that the donor nations deal with that question of corruption and dysfunction?
The corruption is a reality, a sad reality in most developing countries. That is true. The only way out is to make all aid very conditional and to delegate the distribution of aid to institutions. For example, in the case of Turkey now, the aid given to Turkey was not given to the Turkish government where it would disappear in the pockets of some, or at least part of it, but it was given to organizations like the UNHCR and others who would use it to improve the camps. You can do the same in development aid, delegate more, but really make the distribution dependent on observing the criteria of non-corruption and make sure that you observe it, that you watch and verify that the agreement is stuck to. But without a dramatic increase of the aid, things won't change. So my argument is, if you want to prevent the creation of refugees, you have to make it easier for them to stay. And that means you may have to cooperate with corrupt governments, but make sure that the cooperation, the nature of cooperation, assures that no corruption takes place.
Who beside the EU and US of the wealthy nations is accepting refugees? And I would add, in addition to Canada, Russia's population is declining, and China is paving the old Silk Road through Afghanistan.
Russia is actually a country that receives quite a lot of refugees. Lots of Ukrainians that fled east ended up in Russia. There is quite a lot of migration from the south. There's migration of Russians from the various former Soviet republics into Russia. And they have basically refugee status. They're not doing very well. Yes, Russia is declining demographically quite substantially, but there is immigration there. China has none. Japan is the saddest case because it has almost nothing, although it could afford to have more, and it is the country that is declining demographically the most. They could really take some, but they have made a political decision not to do that. And indeed, it would be difficult for them. You see, the European countries have a history of immigration. Just take France or Germany, or Britain. They all had Britain, the Commonwealth, France, the former empire, Germany, all the flows of refugees coming in from the east, then the Turks in the 1960s and 70s. They are used to it. They can take it much better. And the part of Germany that is least used to it, that's East Germany, that is where you have anti-immigration movements. The former East German communist country, they didn't have any immigrants, unlike West Germany that had so many. So, yes, there are other countries that are immigrant countries, but we are talking primarily about the OECD countries. And here, of course, we must include the United States. The United States is not doing that much in the field of refugee policy because the vetting process is, contrary to what some people say, is extremely detailed. It takes 2 years, normally, until you come in. And the result is that not that many can come in. It's easy to come in if you are skilled labor or if you have money to spend in the country. Most immigrants actually come from India, and most of them end up in Silicon Valley. That's the largest number of immigrants in the United States, is Indians.
What about Canada? They have welcomed Syrian refugees. How many can the Canadians absorb? And do you think that Trudeau will stay the course?
I don't know whether he will stay the course, but at the moment it's rather impressive. They have accepted, I checked the numbers, 29,000 people. And about half of that is private. They're private organizations, the rest is government. And they're doing it, and they're running what some politicians in this country consider a deadly risk, okay. But they're doing it. And for the time being, the policy, from what I gather, enjoys support, both by the civil society, but also by the political system. So I think Trudeau is doing all right. It doesn't harm him to accept all those Syrian refugees.
Thank you. And my last question will give you a chance to give us a little bit of a pep talk again. You have spoken of the need for a paradigm shift in America's willingness to accept refugees. What are the factors that must be changed to affect this cultural shift, and how can we contribute?
Only a public discourse which exposes the problem and the decision in the voting booth will deal with that. Those who argue that the place has to close down have to be defeated. Very simple. And one has to contradict those who think that this country cannot afford it. And that is, as somebody put it, who aspires to the presidency, a hellhole. It is not. The country is in good shape. Economically, it's better off than most OECD countries. Definitely, it can take more. And it has a tradition of absorbing the talents of the world. Why should that stop? And in particular, it has a tradition of not refusing people in dire straits. I mean, of course, it has happened before. Think of the Jews who tried to escape the Nazism, who had to turn back. We cannot afford this as a country. That's not what we are as America. And that is not the country that liberated me from Nazism.
Thank you again, Dr. Carl Kaiser, for a wonderful talk. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at monadnocklyceum.org.